Hey, Let's Coach Mike here, LexCoachMike.com. Premium guys, you are the best. Special, special thanks to our great friends at Crossover for sponsoring this podcast. I am so excited. You can probably hear it in my voice. You know, I've been getting emails for a year and a half about this coach, and we finally got him on. Joe Amplo, Marquette. Man, new program in 4 years. What a splash they've made, huh? In 2014, he was the Big East Conference Coach of the Year. These guys have done incredibly well, beating a lot of big teams, including tournament teams the last couple of years. Marquette has qualified for the semifinals of the Big East tournament during each year as a league member and increased its overall win total in each season. Not easy to do if you're a new program. Amplo's got quite a pedigree. You know, he comes to Marquette with 11 years coaching experience, 10 of which at Hofstra. Actually coached under Donowski and Seth Tierney, which is kind of interesting in how we opened the interview. There's a lot of stuff in this podcast, some philosophical stuff on practices as well as some great drills. Again, I am just thrilled. Can't wait for you to hear this, Coach. He's wonderful. We got to have him back. Coach Joe Amplo, Marquette, special thanks to our friends at Crossover, and special thanks to all of you. Without further ado, my first interview with this coach, and I guarantee you it won't be my last.
Hey, Lats Coach Mike here, LatsCoachMike.com. Man, it's a big day. For the 50 people or more that sent me emails, chill, man. We finally were able to coordinate schedules with Coach Joe Amplo, doing a great job up there at Marquette in a very short period of time. Coach, we are absolutely thrilled to have you on the site. Thank you so much.
Mike, I am thrilled to be with you this morning. I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, I want to talk about practice plans, but and I think the listeners and our members know who you are, you know, but they may not know your background in detail. And I just have a quick question for you, man. I love, you know, Coach Donowski's been very good to our site, and I love Coach Donowski, and he's, you know, been esoteric. And the listeners know in real life, you know, what I do. I research, you know, millennials and Gen X, and Coach has read my book on the Gen X, you know, and we've talked about it, kind of esoteric. And then you were coaching under Seth, right? And when I interview Seth, I kind of like say, welcome, Seth. And then I put the phone on the desk, you know. Two totally different. And hey, listen, there's a lot of guys I interview like that. You know, I would put Hank Jancic in the same category. I would put Dave Cottle in that category, you know. Cottle, you want one more, Mike? I got one more, you know. Yeah, like I said, it's been blessed, but that had to be a great education, for a young coach, just being in the two different cultures. So I would like to ask you about those two different personalities, equally as effective. Both guys love lacrosse. They're incredible, incredible guys. I love having them on the site. I've spent a lot of time with those guys individually, face to face, one on one, talking about coaching. But I want to hear your comment on that very briefly, and then do you fit in the middle someplace?
Well, I think I do. I, to be honest with you, I'm probably more on the school of thought, Coach Donowski, but teaching is my base. He told me, he said, you're not a coach, yeah. You're a teacher, and you're an educator before anything else. And that's been my foundation, you know, and for me, watching what he's done there at Duke, it's heartwarming, to be honest with you, that he hasn't changed one iota. He's still the same coach in person as he was at Hofstra, and now he's just at one of the world's best universities. So certainly he's risen to the top. But it certainly was an interesting path that I had, you know, fortunate to be on with working with John and playing for him, and then working with Seth. I mean, heck, that's two guys who have won a national championship at two different places.
Right, no doubt.
So to have that opportunity to see how they operate and how they run their programs was fascinating. You know, like I said, John's a fundamentalist, a teacher. He's about development and growth and learning from mistakes. And Seth is one of the more, I would say, intense, fiery individuals that this sport is blessed to have. You know,
one of the top three passionate guys we've ever interviewed, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and he's very strong in his thoughts, and that taught me, you know, if you have a thought, you've got to believe in it, and you can convince people that it's right, and about motivating a group and just getting guys to buy into something that you believe in. I think in coaching, one of the biggest things that I've learned is that your idea, it's not selling it. It's just your passion has to come through. If you're not passionate about it, then you've got no chance of your team buying into what you're trying to teach them.
Well,
and
you
Steph
know,
Steph certainly taught me that.
I think the I don't want to say all, you know, because everybody's got a different way of making it work. But I think even over the last 5 years, and even with guys that you would not think traditionally, guys like Bill Tierney, guys like Petro, have increased their level of transparency with their teams. And I think they have become, you know, more honest with their teams about what they're trying to accomplish. And then even Richie Mead, you know, about blew me over when, you know, we were talking, one of the things that we talk about at the corporate level all the time is when people ask you why, it's not necessarily a, you know, a sign of insubordination. Young people grow up watching the media question authority figures every day. You know, so a lot of young people, it's just kind of accepted, you know, that I can ask why. And a lot of old coaches freak out, or traditional coaches, not necessarily age, has nothing to do with it, freak out, you know, when somebody wants to know, why are we doing this drill, or why are we doing it this way? You know, and Richie Mead said, it took me a while to learn, even Richie Mead, man, I mean, he said, it took me a while to learn that it's not insubordination, it's a sign of interest. You know, and you see those coaches explaining why. To your point, you know, believing so deeply in what they're doing and analyzing and coming up with drills that emulate game scenarios. Yeah, it's amazing. I've told the listeners, Coach, when I get off the podcast, I'm usually melancholy, you know, and I'm married to the greatest hippie lacrosse chick of all time for 36 years, the greatest coach's wife. Well, there's a lot of great coaches' wives out there, but mine's right up there. And she's got the interview going. I'm going, man, the guy was awesome. She goes, why are you so sad? Because he told me 10 things I should have been doing 30 years ago, you know. So, Coach, I know we got fall ball, and I know we got spring ball, and I know we got 2 days before a game and everything else. But do you have a basic practice template that you subscribe to? Or, I mean, clearly we're very familiar with Donowski's practice plans as well as Seth. But can you walk us through kind of what happens generally in a practice, whether it's 90 minutes or 2 hours, and maybe comment just in general categories, and then maybe comment a little bit on how you've tweaked that or modified that or moved stuff around, if you have, in that fact?
Sure. Yeah, the thing I've learned since being here is that, you know, coaching a really young team when we started, heck, we had 32 freshmen my first year here.
Yeah.
And we had to manage their immaturity, you know, and their inexperience, their youth. So what I learned quickly was less is more. At less time, less length of drills, less intensity at different points. Just, I mean, heck, the thing I think I've probably realized is that we've got to keep these kids' interest. And they're pulled in so many different directions. You know, they're attached to their phones. You know, if a drill goes 10 minutes, they're worried about, you know, what's on Twitter 10 minutes later, you know.
Yeah.
And we've got to keep their interest. So our practices have become much shorter. Most of the time, I mean, it could be even a Monday or a Tuesday practice with a week to prepare for a team. We're very, very rarely more than 90 minutes start to finish, and that's with stretching. There are some days where we'll practice for 60 minutes because I believe that it's better to have a more intense, shorter burst of practice than a longer, less intense. I'd rather have the guys give us their best for a shorter time than an average, you know, output or execution for a longer time. So keeping their interest and making sure that they're excited is the most important thing. For us, our practice planning always starts with the fundamentals. You know, I'm an old football player from high school, and I grew up that way, that the team that blocks and tackles the best is the team that's probably going to win. And in our sport, it's no different. If the team picks up the ground balls more than the other team and shoots it past the other team's goalie and throws it to their team, there's a good chance they're going to win the game. So we very, very strategically focus on fundamentals at the beginning of our practices every single day. And it's as simple as the passing and catching, not old school line drills, but more unique, just passing and catching, getting repetition. passing and catching drills, and then, you know, obviously ground ball work. And we do a really good job, I think, of practicing the fundamentals of each position. So a lot of individual work with the defensive guys and technique and form, working on approach, offensively, just the dodging patterns and specific movements for those guys. And then now with the way the face-off games become so impactful, having those guys practice their technique and their craft on a daily basis is something that we really focus on. Because it's such a simple game. And I think that you can't just say you're going to be good at the fundamentals or say you're going to pay attention to the details without really focusing on it on a daily basis. So we start there. And then one of the things we do in the beginning of every practice is we stole this from our basketball guys a couple of years ago. We call it shop coaching. And it's just a way for us to get their attention early in practice where maybe right after stretching, whatever it is we want to focus on that day specifically, it could be a transition component, it could be 6-on-6, something that the other team is going to do that we want to prepare for. We'll come up with a 5 to 8 minute competitive drill, split the team in half or in quarters, and have those guys compete with a consequence. And that'll be the first thing we'll do. You know, so for instance, let's say we're going to focus on man up, man down, and trying to scout the other team's EMO or EMD. We'll split the team in half and make teams out of it, and then you know, play best out of 5 or best out of 7, and make it a consequence, so that the guys are excited. There's competition early, and then once that's finished and they pay their consequence, then we go into our fundamentals, and fundamentals into the individual groups, and then typically we'll bring our guys back together in some small team components, whether it's a 4-on-4 type drill or a half field setting. And then our transition game is always in the middle of practice.
Yeah, Coach, let me stop you there for a second. So yep. You're going to, the kids are going to come out. Are they doing shooting on their own, or you have a voluntary pre-practice period or something like that?
Yes. So, you know, typically, so for us, it's a little bit weird, Mike, because we have an indoor facility that we have to travel to right now, about 15 minutes. And some of those days, it's, you know, you get there and you've got 90 minutes start to finish. So by the time we get off the bus, there could be 10 or 12 minutes for the guys to basically get the field set up and go through some.
Are you a morning or an afternoon guy?
Shooting. In the fall, we're a morning group. And then in the springtime, we're an afternoon operation.
Okay.
To answer your question, I'm sorry, to answer your question, there is about a 15-minute pre-practice routine that the guys will go through.
And then we're going to stretch, and then we're going right into the shock or the high-intensity consequence segment.
Correct.
And then we're going to come back to fundamentals.
So get them going.
Yeah, so you're
going
to light them up at the beginning of practice, kind of set the tone of what's going to happen that day. Get the energy level high, get some hooting and hollering going on, and then you're going to come back God, I hate to even use the word coach. You know, perhaps it might slow down a little bit, you know, in the fundamental phrase.
Oh, it's definitely going to slow down. I mean, I'm not afraid to say that. You know, we're going to teach at that point.
Well, yeah, you're famous. You know. I'm just a guy in Atlanta, so yeah, you don't have to be afraid, but I got to be afraid, man.
Yeah, but I think setting the standard or maintaining our standard for the level of intensity for competition for practice, because at the end of the day, if there's a winner or a loser, what we're trying to do. So we want to maintain that focus at the start of each practice to make sure our guys understand that. And then we'll go back into our fundamentals and slow it down a little bit and focus on the details and then try and ramp it up again. You know,
hey, Joe, let me ask you a quick question. Have you found any new ideas under consequences?
Well,
it's a question I get every month. You know, the guys are going, hey, man, you know, I'm sick of telling the guys the losers have to run or pick up balls, and it seems to be so much more oriented to the losers. We've had a lot of college coaches, you know, using who gets to eat first as kind of an incentive for the winners, you know. But, you know, most high school coaches that doesn't apply to. Have you come up with any new ideas, or is there anything that the kids kind of grin when you make them do?
You know, I wish I could say yes, but
I'm having trouble.
There's a reason why coaches have used the running adage for generations, because it's the one that the kids don't like the most. You know, so
right.
I think that's the most most impactful consequence. But the thing, we don't do a lot of the running at the end. It's like, you know, the guys are going to, like you said, eat for us to do something like that. But for us, it's, we want the guys to feel bad about losing. And it's just, you know, you lose, there's competition there. So just the fact that you lost whatever drill or consequence there is, then that's what we're trying to build, you know, is that the guys just learn that losing is not okay.
So now we're out of fundamentals, and before I so rudely interrupted you, being like Coach of the Year and all, you mentioned you're going to come back into a 4x4. I mean, where are we time-wise here, Coach? What are we, about 30, 35 minutes in or something?
Yeah, from the start of that stretch,
yeah,
we're probably at the 30-minute mark.
Okay.
And then, so from there, it's 4-on-4 drills, you know, where it could be offense, scout offense against the scout D, offense against the, you know, and vice versa. So splitting up in 2 half fields, 4-on-4s. And there's a teaching component there that here we're trying to focus on the small part to our half field game. And then that's a 10-minute segment. Okay. So the defensive coaches will work on the other team's offense, saying this is what we're trying to defend. And then the offensive coaches will work on the other team's defense. This is what we're trying to attack. And then after that, we'll bring the entire group together and do a 8-minute competitive 4-on-4 or 5-on-5 half field segment, so that everybody's on one end. It's high repetition, it's high intensity, and it's competitive. So now the thing that we had to focus on early here was, you know, there's no hierarchy to our roster. We want to make sure that the second half, which perceived to be the second half of our roster, has enough opportunity to perform when it's a level playing field. Not that they're just the scout team, or, you know, they're not that they're just pretending to be Georgetown's offense or Georgetown's defense. We want to give them an opportunity to play as Marquette for as much of a time as possible, so that they can improve and they can perform and impress the coaches and move up or down the depth chart. So while there is a scouting component in our practice, we've got to make sure we maintain that level of opportunity for our guys throughout the practice.
So, Coach, the 4v4, I mean, obviously, for years, Coach, we're running that out of a Y formation. In the last year or so, we've seen guys even start that out of a 1v1 ground ball, you know, where the winner stays and the loser's out. Are you mixing up the way you start those 4v4s? And my second half of the question is, you know, I find the 5v5 thing pretty intriguing. You know, I think the first guy, believe it or not, was Uncle Hank Danzig, man, maybe 2.5 years ago. You know, as guys really, you know, kind of, I think, and I'm generalizing, but, you know, maybe going back a few years before, you always try to get a good look or a structured look or something, I don't want to say scripted, but semi-scripted look before you went into the sub pattern, you know, when the ball came down or off a face-off. Over the last year or so, we've seen guys try and make that a 5v5 scripted look as opposed to a, you know, let's run it with the guys that come down and then we'll substitute off. How are you starting, and are you mixing it up, and do you have any creative ways that you're initiating either the 4v4 or the 5v5 work? And can you talk a little bit about 5v5?
Yeah, so first with the 4-on-4, Mike, for us, we typically do it 3 different ways. You've got the traditional Y drill where the ball is always going to start with a pass from a coach from a different angle, because we want to make sure that we focus on the attackman or the midfielder who's attacking that ball is setting himself up with either a V-cut or just simply running to the man who he's catching the ball from. And then
yeah,
second to that.
Love it, love it,
and,
love
and our,
it. Yeah.
And our defender is got to work on his approach and the timing of his approach and his setup. So we have to start there. And that's typical for us, even if we do one-on-ones. We're always going to start with a pass.
Right.
And then so the 4-on-4, we'll start with that, and then it will be a Y, what we call Y from behind. So the
right.
ball will go to the attack net X.
No, we're
and then
we're
when
with
we
you.
Do, go ahead.
No, I said I'm with you.
Yep. So, and then the second ball will be a Y from up top. But now that kind of changes because it goes from a Y with two middies top left and right, and we stack them. We put them in an I formation. So basically, those same players will be involved in that drill. After the ball is played out with the guy who dodged from behind, then another ball will be entered, and the midfielder now will catch the ball top center. And his midfield partner will just get into an I formation below him, and will play from there. So it's really a true I formation with a midi top center, a second midi probably at the top of the box or just inside, an attackman on the crease, and then an attackman at X. And we play from there. You know, that changes the slide angles, that changes the defensive communication, and it allows our offense to react to what is typical in our motion offensive work, where we're going to dodge from that top center of the cage, and then depending on where that dodger goes, our other offensive players are going to react accordingly.
So you and almost, then, we would call that on our website almost a toggle look.
Okay.
Run it from behind with the group, and then the same group stays, and you're immediately, bang, going to run it from up top.
Right. Yeah. And then we typically keep the same eight guys in for three balls. So the third ball will enter at any point, and we tell the guys we're going to be in a wide look. Just no crease, and then it's freelance, and you can do what you want. Because what we're trying to do, Mike, is we're trying not to be very scripted, both offensively and defensively, because we want our kids to learn how to play with and off of each other. And mostly defensively, we're trying to enhance or teach the communication. And the only way that I think you can teach that, or the best way you can teach that, is to put kids in uncomfortable situations where they're forced to work with each other. You know, it's kind of scramble defense. You're going to give them the basics of, I'm one, you're my two, we're going to slide from here. But you've got to put them in situations where it's not obvious what's going on, and they've got to react to it. Because I believe that's what happens in most breakdowns in offense and defense. Kids are out of their comfort zone, and they've got to be comfortable playing with discomfort, comfortable playing with, they got to figure out who's hot when a dodger's dodging from a different angle and there's not a really established crease man. So we try and put our kids in those situations as much as we can. And what we found is that the 4-on-4 drill with just a freelance look is one of the better ways to do it, because there's no script to it.
I couldn't agree more. Coach, time on the segments?
That one's a 10 or 12 minute one. That's one where, heck, we get so much out of it that there's days where I'll go off the practice plan if we like the intensity of it, if we like the execution, where we'll script a 10-minute segment, but we'll make it a 12 or 15-minute segment if it's good.
But, I mean, the same eight guys out there with three balls, you know, years and years and years ago, you know, Jeff Goldberg used to say, I blow the whistle when they put me to sleep. If that thing starts to drag, are you just going to the top side or toggling it or going to the open set or start to count down 15 seconds so they got to go? I mean...
Oh, that three balls takes less than a minute. It takes less than a minute. I mean, if that offensive player doesn't draw a slide or get to the goal, I blow the whistle. He rolls.
So we're driving and going and making it happen.
Going.
Okay.
Going.
Yeah.
And
great.
We'll probably get in a 10-minute segment, heck, we'll get at least 20 good repetitions. You know, 20 different groups in there. There's no doubt about it. And that may be different for the high school guys, you know, and that may be one where if you have a team of 45 guys, you can do that same drill on two ends, you know. And there's days where if we want to make it real intense, we'll split that group in two. Just split it evenly down the middle and do one end of 4-on-4, another end of 4-on-4 so that the guys are getting more repetitions.
So what brought you into the 5v5 kind of version of that, Coach?
Yeah, it goes back to what I said a few minutes ago, Mike, where we were trying to put our guys in situations that they were uncomfortable or it was less obvious.
Yeah,
you know,
I love
with
it.
The 6-on-6, it's so scripted, it's so obvious. But you know, lacrosse isn't like that all the time. So I think a 5-on-5, it forces guys to play in just a unique way. Offensively, there's more space, so it opens up more dodging lanes, more passing lanes. It makes the defense have to focus on defending those lanes more, and it puts them in situations where they're not always sliding from that you know, 5 yards in front of the goal area, where they've just got to figure it out and work together. You know, and offensively, it forces guys to be more aggressive. You know, so now when you go to 6-on-6 and you put those extra two guys in there, a Dodger who played a few minutes earlier in a 5-on-5 set may have that a different aggressiveness with the ball on a stick, because he knows he can maybe get to a spot that he didn't think he could normally get to, because he saw a field that was opened up in a previous drill. So,
Coach, do you start the 5v5 out of different sets, or do you have a configuration that you're running that out of all the time?
No, we'll do it out of different sets. Some days it'll be, if we know we're going to play with against a double crease, it'll be one attack from behind, two guys on the crease, two guys up top. Sometimes it'll be two guys behind, one on the crease, two up top. It could be a high wing look where you've got, the umbrella look, top left, top middle, top right, a crease man and a guy at X. And we'll just throw out different patterns at our guys based on what we're trying to work on.
Interesting.
And, you know, and to be honest with you, that forces us, that's kind of taking the part out of the whole. You know, for instance, the umbrella look, if you're going to see an umbrella offense and defensively you're trying to prepare against that, well, you don't really need to focus on the two attacking behind. You need to get a lot of repetitions with the four guys in front of the cage. But you can't forget about the guy at X, because the ball is going to transfer through there. So putting three guys across the top and one on the crease and only one behind just now pretty much forces the ball to stay in front of the cage a lot of the time and only use that guy at X as a relay man. You know, so you're getting more repetition with what you're trying to focus on from a defensive or offensive standpoint just by taking one player off the field.
No, I love it, man. I'm all about different. I mean, keep it engaging, keep it different. Let the guys go play. So where are we now? Now we got to be about 45 minutes in or 50 minutes in?
Yep, so now we'll go into more full field stuff. So a lot of transition work, where we'll usually have one or two drills from a transition standpoint. And in this segment, we will mix in. This is probably about a 20 or 25 minute segment. We will always do full field face-off / subbing work. So our transition game, it can be a 8 or 10 minute transition drill, and the standard ones where it could be midfielders at the box with an attack and D on both ends, and we'll roll a ground ball out,
right,
make it a 4-on-3 or a 5-on-4 ground ball,
right,
and add guys accordingly to get to 6-on-6. And then typically we'll do a drill like that, and then before we move to another transition drill, we'll throw in a full field face-off. So 5 or 7 minutes of face-off work, and we will do it a number of different ways. It could be play to a possession, so possession in the box. It could be play to a shot. It could be play to a full sub with a possession. So working on your subbing game. And the difference in those three instances is if you're going to play to a full sub, you're getting less face-off repetitions, but you're working on your subbing game and the things that you're trying to do there from a strategic standpoint.
Right.
If you're going to play to a shot, you're getting more face-off work, but there you've got to be mindful of the energy output of your face-off guys. You know, because if you're going to do that drill for 8 minutes and now you're just doing face-offs to a shot or to a possession, those kids might get 15 or 20 face-offs and they're going to be gassed.
Yeah.
So there's some strategy there with just managing it from a coaching standpoint. But doing it in the middle of practice there, now it's telling our face-off kids, hey, we didn't forget about you. And we're saying that this is really important from a team perspective. You guys have worked on your face-off craft for, you know, a good portion of the first part of practice with individual work and maybe some extra work through the drills. Now we're going to put you guys in position to work from a team perspective. Wing play, fast break stuff off of that, all of the strategy that goes into the face-off game we'll do in that middle part of practice. And then typically we'll go to another transition drill. One we like a lot is three-quarter transition, where we'll put all of our attack and defense down one end in opposite colors. We'll take the offensive middies and we'll put them in the same color as the defense, and the defensive middies in the same color as the offense. and basically I'll just script different transition patterns from the opposite end of the field so that now our offensive middies are playing transition defense and our defensive middies are playing transition offense.
Yeah, we had the most fascinating podcast, I don't know when it was, probably about the middle of the season, with Lars Tiffany. And, you know, Brown at that time was on a great run. You know, I don't remember what it was, but it was a number of games in a row. And, you know, he was, I don't know what the right word is, not melancholy, but he was in a very studious or self-absorbed or deep-thinking mode that day, okay?
That doesn't surprise me about Lars.
Oh, man, we love Lars. We love Lars. And he's been very good to us. But he had just had a grad assistant or something compile more detailed stats on the time of play on the field differential between the O-middies and the D-middies, okay? And remember the context here. They're coming off a scenario where I think they had won like 7 out of 8 or 6 out of 7. And, I mean, they were really playing well. And even with that being said, I want to say their last two games, their offensive middies were on the field like 18 minutes.
Right.
And you know, he was, in the true Lars Tiffany way, kind of esoterically and deep-thinking analysis of who's an O-middy and who's a D-middy and what are the skill sets and how often do we want these guys on the field. And, yeah, obviously this drill plays to, you know, that point, doesn't it? I mean, O-mids aren't always O-mids. As a matter of fact, they may not be O-mids as much as you think they are.
No. In fact, our defensive midfielders, we want them to produce more shots than our offensive midfielders.
Yeah, that's really interesting change over the last 2 years, don't you think, Coach?
Yeah. And if you look at it from a minute standpoint, to Lars's point, the defensive middies is probably going to play 50% of the game. From if you take all of the midfield runs, your short stick D middies and your long stick are going to play 50% of the time. Because if you're going to run two offensive midfields, that first midfield probably is going to get 80% of the offensive runs, but that's only, you know, it might be 30% of the runs through the game.
Exactly.
And then your second midfield might get 20% of the offensive runs, which could be, you know, another 10 or 15%, but your defensive midfield is playing every defensive run. So now, and they're the ones running from defense to offense. So they need to be able to be proficient in that offensive, you know, attempt from defense to offense. And then on the flip side, your offensive midfield are the ones running in the hole. So if they don't understand how to play a 5-on-4 or 5-on-5 or slow break defense or get off the field in a subbing pattern, you're going to give up goals in an area of the field where it's become really important. You know, teams are really focusing on that first 15 to 30 seconds when the ball crosses the midline. You know, that, to me, that's the difference between one goal wins and one goal losses, because as coaches, we're going to coach the heck out of 6-on-6. That's easy. You know, that's the obvious part of our game. But it's that transition, slow break, middle of the field breakdown or taking advantage of that makes the difference between, you know, being the, on the right side of a 9-8 win. And we really focus on that a lot just to put our guys in situations to have them have those experiences because you can't script it. You know, 6-on-6, you can script. They're going to dodge from here. This is their pattern. This is what they want to do. Middle of the field stuff, you can't script. The only way to do it is to do it. The only way to get better at it is to do it. So
yeah, I think it was Pressler that told us, another incredibly analytical guy, incredibly analytical, suggested that he had tracked every goal for like the last 26 centuries, you know, on teams he had coached. And I think he said 86%, you know, were some mini snapshot of transition. And was always challenging himself to keep closer to 70 or 80% of his practices in transition. To your point, you know, and now we get to the point where how do we manufacture transition out of a 4v4? How do we manufacture transition out of a 6v6? Those kind of things all play into it too.
Right. And to, you know, to those points is how do you learn from the mistakes that the kids are making, right? So if you're gonna, if you're not gonna do it in practice, the only time you're gonna have those opportunities is in a game. Well, then those mistakes are costly. But if you're gonna do it in practice and try and teach your defensive middies right from wrong when making a decision in transition offense, well, you gotta do it in practice so that you can hold them accountable and you can teach them right from wrong so they understand time and place and situation and when to push it and when not to push it. So those things, I think that has really, that's been the biggest transformation I've seen in the last 10 years is how impactful that part of the game has become.
No doubt. I agree. So where do we go after the transition segment? And you got a number of transition drills you're throwing into this segment too. I mean, we're not just doing three-quarter field stuff.
No, I got there's probably 10 or 12 that we'll use, and they're pretty standard. You know, I'm not
right.
Our creativity with the transition stuff is not great. We're pretty standard with just trying to keep odd numbers. We'll do some half field transition stuff with like 3-on-2s and, you know, 4-on-3s and stuff, but it's nothing earth shattering. So that's why I'm excited to get access to your site, Mike, to steal some good ideas.
I tell you where we've seen a lot of the creativity in the transition drills, and you know, everybody has different words. I don't know why, you know, no reason. I kind of use the term crunch, you know, running the crunch drills. And, you know, I think the first coach we talked that really made it an inherent or a pretty significant portion of his practice was Bates when he was still back at Princeton. And, you know, I think the advent of the box players and Bates running the, back in those days, you know, he was one of the guys that really more than others at that time in lacrosse history, I think, you know, really pushed the two man and the pick and slips and stuff like that. And in his effort to be able to get the bags out of the kids' sticks and get them to throw a 12-yard pass or a 6-yard pass at 65 miles an hour, you know, he was crunching the field, if you will. And you know, J.B. Clark is another big crunch guy. But they would, you know, put the cones out there and make the kids play in a confined space and, you know, 3v2 or 4v3. Now we've seen a lot of guys do some interesting stuff with that. I want to say it was Colfer at Cabrini actually put the cones on the hash marks, Coach, 10 yards inside the box and on the hash marks, and would have the three guys in different places, but they had to play 3v2, trying to mentally reinforce where we want you to shoot from, as well as playing 3v2 in a confined space. You know, and I tell coaches when I do coaching clinics on what we've learned on the site, none of it is my stuff. I don't get the credit, but man, if you can get your kids to play in that crunch space, when they get into an open field, it's like the first time your dad lets you out of the parking lot learning how to drive a car, you know. You're going, oh, wow, man, roll down the window, put my arm out, turn the radio up, I got all this space, you know. Are you playing around with any of that crunch stuff or the Canadian influence stuff in terms of the transition?
Absolutely. I mean, next year we're going to have 11 Canadians on our team, so a lot of the
wow.
stuff we do is in confined
wow.
space. The old Jenny drill where you bring the cages up to the tops of the boxes and you play 3-on-2 from there, that is a staple in our – that we'll do a lot of that in our shot coaching phase. And, you know, sometimes the end of practice just to get the guys feeling good about what they did. That's a fun drill, a lot of repetitions, you know, a lot of quick passes, 2-on-1, 3-on-2 type stuff. We do a drill that I think we stole from Bates. Ironically, the 3-on-2 Crusader drill, where it's a ground ball in the box, and it's a transition situation, but it's just an odd man ground ball,
right?
You know, and then my favorite drill of all time is Coach Stanowski's probably favorite. We call it Cone of Silence. We created this at Hofstra probably about 15 years ago, where you move the cage into the women's crease, and we call it little cone or big cone. So I don't know what the women call those things, but they look like ice cream cones to us. And those are the boundaries. And, you know, the 8-meter or the free position areas, we line our guys up around that. And it's two lines, one on the right, one on the left, on the borders of those boundaries. And then I'll say, all right, it's a 2-on-2, 3-ball drill, or it's a 3-on-2, 2-ball drill. And I basically roll a ground ball out in there, and it is a free-for-all. If you pick the ball up, you're on offense. If you don't, you're on defense. If you knock the ball out of the guy's stick, you can pick it up and you're on offense. So now, you're creating tough ground balls. You're creating transition, odd man situations. You're trying to teach guys to play in small space. That drill is probably the most impactful, most fun. That's a drill that's helped establish our culture because there could be no sissies in the cone of silence. You got to be a tough guy to go in there and pick up a two-handed ground ball and move it and find the open man.
Oh man, we're coming up on our time, but you got to walk me through this. So, Danowski, holding out on me, man. He told me about the Little Feet playlist, but I didn't get this.
he dropped Little Feet on you, huh?
That's another great story. I got to tell you sometime. Yeah, I mean, Kucinich, you know, on ESPN got nothing on me, man. I know Danowski's playlist. What kind of interviewer am I, you know? So we got these, the players are lined up, okay, on that little triangle. And then when you say like 3v2, does that mean like three from one line and two from the other line? Then you're going to throw the ball in to that little triangle and they got to play in the triangle?
So basically, exactly right. So I'll be at the top of the triangle or arc, whatever you want to call it, with a bucket of balls. And there'll be a team on my right in gold, a team on my left in blue. And they'll be fanned out along that arc. So the end of the line is more toward the goal line extended. The top of the line is literally right to my right and right to my left.
Exactly.
And you just move forward. So now we'll put a goalie in the cage, and I'll say, all right, two gold, two blue. Those guys go in and stand on the women's crease. They put their feet in it. And I'll say, all right, three ball drill. And I'll roll a ball out anywhere. I'll bounce it. I'll throw it in the air. I'll just drop it inside the cone. If the ball leaves the cone or a player steps out of bounds of that cone, whistle blows and I immediately throw another ball in. Or if that ball gets scored. Now there's, like I said, there's no offense and defense. Whoever's got the ball on their stick, they can shoot and score, they can make a pass, and then those guys are in for three balls. But what they don't do is they don't reset after each whistle. They just stop, the ball's out of the cone or it's in the cage, and I roll another one out. So you can create a one-on-one ground ball out of a drill.
Where have you been all my life? I love this. I love this. You just went to my new favorite coach, man. That's saying something.
That was easy. I got to give Dino credit for that one. So.
Oh, that is, and so you're announcing how many guys from each line as well as how many balls they're going to be in the cone of silence for.
Yeah, I mean, when I say we're doing cone of silence, our team erupts. They love it. They love the drill.
I've never run the drill, and I'm erupting, man. I love that.
Yeah. We made a mistake of using this drill in pregame warm-ups our first year, and we had guys getting hurt, you know. And it's funny. We did it. We were doing it when we were playing Duke our first year, and Dino's on the other end of the field. Him and Matt Danowski are walking past, going to the locker room, and I scream cone of silence, and our team erupts, and those guys just start laughing because they couldn't believe we were doing that drill before we were going to play. So,
yeah, and for high school or U15 coaches, you know, before you use the girls' arc, if you got a U15 team, you can run this drill, just put the flat cones down there and maybe make it, you know, 2 yards wider or something to accommodate, you know, U15 guys so they're not just in there wailing on each other and we're actually accomplishing something.
Well, I'll be honest with you, Mike. When we do it with our camp kids and our club teams, the little guys, they love it.
I'm sure.
And you can use the big cone, the little cone. The most challenging one is when we go one on one, and I'll say, all right, first one to three wins, but you got to score three goals. So that you can get 10 balls in there. You know, you can get a guy who's in there for 10 balls, and those guys are completely gassed.
That'd be a great way to end practice.
Yeah. So that's our favorite drill. So, you know, then moving past that on practice planning, it's, you know, the transition stuff leads into, we'll try and get man up, man down, not at the very end of practice, but sometime in that middle, or just after transition. And then it usually goes to some quick 6-on-6 stuff and obviously, you know, full field with, you know, your riding and clearing game and obviously your scrimmage component. One of the things that Seth taught me was always try and get your scrimmages to one in there. And that's, you know, you sneak those in. We sneak those in at any point. It could be at the end of a transition drill. It could be in the middle of your full field face off. It could be just before you're going to go full field scrimmage or just at the end of practice. Get a scrimmage to one in there so that your guys can play with that nervousness of, you know, the next goal wins.
Writing about that for like 2 years. And this year was the first, you know, that I think the light bulb went on, you know, for the high school coaches. And, you know, they shied away from it because of the size of their rosters. You know, if they had 28 guys, you know. And the first, you got a huge delta between, you know, the first attack and the second attack, or attackman number three and attackman number five, or, you know, worlds apart skill-wise. But yeah, they finally started to do that. And we're seeing the same thing with man up, man down, coach. You know, right in the middle of the cone of silence, the guy will say, okay, we got a 1 minute man up and a 1 minute man, or a 30 second, you know, man up, you know, and running it, and then bang, metaphorically, you know, right back into the 4v3 or the cone of silence or whatever it turns out to be, too.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know.
You know what? You're a pretty good coach, man.
Well, no, I've been fortunate to have pretty good players and good assistants. It's, and these are, none of these ideas are mine, so I appreciate
it. Yeah, isn't that the common denominator? I get asked that in every one of my clinics, you know. If you could put your finger on one thing, you know, for your success, because I've been blessed. You know, I always tell them there is no one thing, it's two things. Goalie and face off. If you got goalie and face off, we can coach the rest. You know? I mean, really, if I got goalie and face off, I'm going to be okay. I'm automatically a better coach than if I don't have goalie and face off.
No question. There's three ingredients to success at the college level. Recruit.
Oh,
that's,
man.
That's pretty much it.
Yeah, and I, you know, especially my dialogues off the air, you know, have gotten into the whole, you know, the chagrin of the coaches and the recruiting issues, and I don't know how it gets resolved or what happens, but sooner or later something's got to change. Yeah, it's crazy. All right. Hey, listen, man, God, an hour goes fast, doesn't it?
It does.
I was a little surprised or just different when I was reading about GoldenEagleLacrosse.com. Am I right? Is that kind of a local travel team that you're directing there, Coach?
It is. It's, you know, we wanted to try and capture the kids who were most serious about developing into good lacrosse players in this area. You know, there's great coaches out here. There's a strong push to have the game grow. But if we want to make this a fertile recruiting ground in the next 5 to 10 years, we just felt like we've got to be around these kids as much as we possibly can. So we coach them for the summer, treat them like college kids, and really ramped up the intensity of their lacrosse training. And it just allows us to be around the kids who want to be good at this game. You know, we bring them to a few tournaments. We hire some high school coaches and some of our players to coach them on the weekends. And my staff and I, we coach them for the practices during the week, and it's been great. We've got about 110 kids in the program, and you know, we've got like a 95% retention rate, where most kids who start the program come back. They have fun, but it's a challenge. We push them, and we try and help them understand what it takes to get the most out of themselves as players.
It's amazing. It's amazing to me how there's good lacrosse players all over the country now. And I think it was a year or so ago, the guys in Minneapolis had me up there. I remember it was 9 degrees below zero Fahrenheit without the wind chill when I went up there. You know, and I had like 90 coaches in an auditorium. And, you know, when I met those guys, like 45 of them had played college lacrosse. You know, yeah. I mean, these 13-year-old kids were getting legitimate coaching. I mean, it wasn't a little league dad listening to a few podcasts off a stupid website, you know. Yeah, there's coaches everywhere. There's players everywhere. Man, I didn't I see a kid from Mercer Island or something on your roster? I mean, even the Pacific Northwest. There's unbelievable players up there.
Yeah, there's unbelievable players everywhere. There's kids everywhere, and the game just continues to grow. So, and that's very encouraging for a guy sitting in the Midwest here with just
no
a wealth of talent to recruit from.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, obviously, you know, Columbus, Ohio's been a hotbed. I mean, Ohio's been a hotbed for a fair period of time, and now you're seeing these other places not just have two or three players, but have comprehensive programs that are really, really good. You know, I mean.
Yeah, Mike, in 3 years' time, Minnesota will, a third of our roster will be from Minnesota. I'm convinced of it. Convinced of it.
Yeah, so, I was trying to think, we played, was it Lax Loons up there or somebody?
Yeah, the Loons.
Yeah.
That's one of the club teams up there. But there's just, I mean, there's such well-established club teams and high school teams in that area, and Chicago and Wisconsin's getting better, and certainly Michigan and Ohio, and, you know, St. Louis, heck, Missouri's got kids. So there's kids up and down this area.
And talk to me about the prospect camp. Are you going to do that again in 2015, Coach?
We are. We'll have a prospect camp this summer and then one in the fall. And, you know, we've recruited kids from those two experiences each year. You know, it's just a way to get on campus and learn about us, have a real good orientation of our school, learn how we coach, interact with our staff, get to know our university, and play in front of us. So
yeah, we are a huge, on our website, we are a huge proponent of recruiting camps, you know. I mean, and I kind of learned about it backwards, man. Actually, when I was coaching at Auburn, I used to get, well, I mean, you know, when I was coaching the Copperhead Nationals and some of the other stuff, and, you know, we were winning all across Canada and the U.S. back in the day, you know, kids were coming there because their coaches knew me from the website or the coaches' clinics, you know. And if you wanted to play in the SEC and play a real high level of club ball, which was really good lacrosse, I mean, not Marquette lacrosse, but really good lacrosse, I was amazed at how good it was. I mean, I had like six guys from the MIAA on my team, you know. But I always had two or three D1 transfers coming in, you know. And you started to hear this phrase, no fun D1. And I think guys went into a program where they had no idea of the culture of the coach or the culture of the program, you know.
Yep.
Or everything, and I mean everything that was involved. You know, I tell parents all the time, first question I get from a college coach is, Mike, does he really love lacrosse? Because if he likes lacrosse, he's not going to be successful. I mean,
right.
To play at your level, you got to love the game, you know.
And you got to want a challenge, you know.
And you know, it's. I mean, when I played D1 coach, it was, you know, fall ball was a blast. It was like summer league, and then January 2nd, you went to work for 5 months, and then you went home. You know, it's not that way anymore. But anyway, if you're thinking about, if you've got two or three programs, I tell coaches every day. You got two or three programs you're thinking about, you know, even if you blow off the travel ball that summer and to use the money and go to two or three of these camps where you get to be on the campus. Does the campus feel right? Is it academically right? Is the culture right? Is the coaching staff something you feel comfortable with? A lot of these kids have never been screamed at, and a lot of these guys, as you know, there's still heavy, heavy, heavy screamers out there and guys that try and encourage by belittling. You know, I don't think that works much anymore, but anyway, all those kind of things. So I did not see the stuff on the summer camp. Where do we go to get that? I mean, I saw the fall stuff on the Marquette website. You don't happen to know what your summer dates are,
yeah,
or the campsite, do you, Coach?
Yeah, that's third week in July, I believe, Mike, and I think there's a link on our lacrosse homepage that
there could be, and I just didn't see it too, Coach.
That's, yeah, awesome. I think there's a button that says camp, and it'll redirect you to the camp website. So if you don't find it, just shoot me a note, and I'll send over the link to you.
Yeah, and for the that's great. And for any of the listeners, as always, if you're interested in any of these camps, just shoot me an email, and I will get you in touch with a coach or the appropriate people. Because I think it's so, so important. I think, you know, for a sophomore playing travel ball, that certainly has its good things and its bad things. But if he's a good player and serious about three schools, take the $900 or the $1,200 or whatever it is, and then put it to these camps, which are usually very, very low priced, I think, compared to travel ball.
Yeah.
I think yours was 100 and something, wasn't it, Coach, or 160 or 110, I can't remember, but whatever it was, I mean, compared to $1,200, it was a lot less money. This is where you need to go, man, and obviously this is a great coach and a program that everybody's talking about. Coach, I'm so thrilled that you came on with us today. I'm on page number 5 of my notes here. Love the drills, love the concepts, and just grew to respect your philosophies in a really, really big way, man. There's no wonder you're successful.
Well, Mike, I appreciate it. It was fun talking to you. Hopefully there's another time we can talk and talk further about some more lacrosse stuff. But thanks again for what you do for the sport, and looking forward to spending some time on your site.
Yeah, well, stay on the line with me here, Coach. We got to sign off. We're well past it. This is Lax Coach Mike, laxcoachmike.com. Special thanks to Coach Amplo. Special thanks to our friends at Crossover for helping us sponsor these podcasts. Remember, you got an amazing responsibility in your hands every day, influencing the lives of these young people. Take it seriously. Until next time, God bless everybody.